Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to our program. Today, I'll be continuing with the ongoing series on vaccines, a second opinion. Vaccination issues, immunological issues, are in the news constantly. I would like to refer specifically to just three reports that have come in just in the last week. I receive between 15 to 20 such reports in any given week. Unfortunately, most of this information does not make it within the mainstream media. Hence, most people are simply unaware of their existence. This comes from Joshua Bear. The subject is genetically engineered vaccines that Bayer Company produced and their effects. I'll quote verbatim, a vaccine used to prevent cows from getting influenza, the IBR vaccine, was introduced 2 years ago. Vaccination was made obligatory, but from the very first day, it went wrong. Thousands of cows died and got severely ill within a very short time after getting the IBR vaccine. The producer, Bayer Pharmaceutical Company, claimed that in only a handful of cases, it admitted a mistake and that it involved a very limited amount of cows. They claimed that it was a viral contaminated batch of the vaccine and was willing to pay some compensation. In all the other cases, Bayer said proof that the problems were caused by the vaccine was not available. After the problems became too big, the vaccination program got suspended. About 1,000 farmers are until now not getting any compensation for the deaths or disease of their animals. IDDLO claims that now a synthetic version by a company, Intervet, should have solved the problem. Restart on a for now voluntary basis of the vaccination is now beginning, but immediately the very first new deaths are also being reported. The vaccine was developed by the Dutch Institute IDDLO in Leestad. IDDLO has a patent on the vaccine, and Bayer pays royalties to the institute. Guess who was asked to evaluate the problems with the vaccine and see if the vaccine had been the cause of these deaths, right? IDDLO, the manufacturer. A parliamentarian committee has judged that the review was, quote, impartial, unquote. Bayer has always denied that genetic engineering had been involved. When asked, they answered it occurred from a, quote, natural mutant, unquote. However, today, at a genetic engineering congress in Leestad, a courageous farmer revealed that in a Bayer release folder, public relations folder from 1996, 2 years before the introduction, Bayer stated that a gene from a donor organism had been deleted. This PR folder was, however, quickly withdrawn. Why? A journalist who was investigating the whole issue has received several anonymous and serious threats. This amazing discrepancy has not made it into the mainstream media. What does this mean? This means that, once again, an experimental vaccine that was genetically engineered caused the death and illness of cows. That's one issue. What about the people who drank the milk or ate the meat from those cows? If you have a genetically engineered virus and it's causing death and disease, and any of those cows continue to be vaccinated or were consumed, we have no idea what that will do in the people's immune systems and overall metabolic activity or the genome of their own cell if they consume it. Separately, this comes from John Whiteshides, and is concerning the anthrax shots and illnesses linked. This is from Reuters News Service. I'll quote, the military's mandatory anthrax inoculations are making people sick and should be halted or made voluntary. A series of witnesses who became ill after taking the shots told Congress on Tuesday, quote, I and my fellow service members who have been sickened by the anthrax vaccine come to you, our elected representatives, for help. Unquote. Major John Ireland told the House Government Reform Committee at a hearing, "Please don't abandon us." Ireland said he was feeling fine before his fourth shot of anthrax vaccine in October 1999, but by the next day he began to suffer weight gain, facial hair loss, shrunken testicles, mood swings, and a loss of strength. Ireland, whose condition improved after he began taking regular testosterone shots, said the Army did not see any connection between the vaccine and his illness, but many of the other witnesses did. Quote, "If you suspected that giving any medication or shot to your son or daughter would risk hurting them, would you hand them the pill or inject them?" Senior Airman Thomas Colosimo asked lawmakers. He told the panel he developed multiple cysts on his skull, suffered repeated blackouts, and had been unable to work or travel since the onset of his condition after he received the vaccine. The Pentagon has sloughed off and slowed down all efforts to resolve it. They have inoculated 2.4 million active and reserve U.S. troops against the deadly anthrax biological agent because of a shortage of vaccine and a lack of final FDA approval for a new supply. Several witnesses complained that military doctors had misdiagnosed their illnesses in an attempt to keep them from pointing a finger at the vaccine program. The hearing follows a recent death of a worker at a Michigan plant of a vaccine supplier, Biport Corporation, in the midst of his series of anthrax shots. A medical examiner said the death was, quote, inflammatory response to the vaccine. But Biport said last week the doctor who performed the autopsy ruled the death could not have been linked to the vaccine. Dunn's wife, Barbara, testified Tuesday that, quote, a lot of people have been made sick by the vaccine, and urged the military inoculation program to be made optional. Quote, nothing can be done to bring back my husband, but I ask this committee to please rethink this program and make it safe. Republican Representative Christopher Shays of Connecticut, whose subcommittee recommended earlier this year that the program be made voluntary until an updated vaccine was developed, said he, quote, can't come to doubt the judgment, the foresight, and the competence of the Pentagon's stewardship of the program. About 487,000 active and reserve troops have taken at least one of the series of vaccinations, but stored supplies of approved vaccines are running short, and no new vaccine is being produced in the United States. The Pentagon has begun to give the vaccinations only to those troops headed for high-risk areas such as South Korea and the Gulf, where they could be threatened by biological agents. Another report, and again, most people are not aware of what's going on in committees and all of the victims of vaccinations coming forward. But unfortunately, they have real difficulty in trying to make their case. And that's unfortunate, because so often when they try to make their case, the government steps in with its experts and says there is no connection. This is an article by M.L. Hardy. Quote, when Marisa of Massapequa, New Jersey, took her seven-month-old son, Jonathan, to the pediatrician for his third series of vaccines, she was thrilled to hear the doctor say her baby was growing so beautifully. 5 hours later, her beautiful baby lay in a crib, shrieking in pain. 45 minutes later, Jonathan was dead. The pediatrician's initial response was that Jonathan had a bad reaction to his DPT vaccine. In 1994, Teresa and her husband watched their healthy baby girl, Miranda, receive her second DPT and HIV vaccines. Within 48 hours, her parents woke to a screaming and shrieking baby. Teresa rushed to her daughter's crib, only to find Miranda in the middle of a seizure. Then suddenly she collapsed, her body seemingly lifeless. An hour later, Miranda, too, was dead. The coroner's report attributed her death to a fatal reaction to the DPT and HIV vaccines. This was the second child Teresa lost to the same vaccine in a six-year period. No one ever told Teresa or Marissa that vaccines can cause death. Each year, the Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control receive between 12 to 14,000 reports of adverse reactions, including severe injuries and deaths, to infants and toddlers following regularly scheduled immunizations. According to a former FDA commissioner, these figures probably represent only 10% of the total adverse reactions to vaccines, since reporting is done voluntarily. That means each year a possible 140,000 infants, toddlers, and adults are experiencing physiological injuries, immunological disorders, and in some cases death after receiving one or more vaccinations. In 1986, in response to the ever-growing number of injuries and fatalities, President Ronald Reagan passed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which established the Vaccine Adverse Reporting System and the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Under this program, all adverse reactions believed to be related to vaccines are reported to this agency for government monitoring purposes. However, since this reporting is entirely voluntarily, it is believed that the actual number of injuries is grossly underreported. Weaknesses in this program were reported as late as 1996. According to the April 1996 FDA Pink Sheet, members of the Vaccine and Related Biologicals Advisory Committee cited flaws in the program, including 1. Passivity of the surveillance system, 2. Underreporting, 3. Lack of control population, 4. Inability to determine causal relationships, 5. Imprecise definition of serious events, and 6. Lack of a mechanism to detect late adverse events. Further flaws in the program were also noted by Dr. Robert Chen, Chief of the Center for Disease Control Office Vaccine Safety and Development. FDA Pink Sheet, dated June 1996, reports his comments, quote, "Of all the positive things that were done by the Vaccine Compensation Act, one thing that was more or less neglected is research. The legislators found a mechanism to fund an injury compensation program after the injury has already happened, but there's really no way at this time to fund research to try to prevent such injuries," unquote. The National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program compensates families who have had loved ones injured, died, or maimed as a result of a vaccine. According to the reports, the official reports, the number of incidents is somewhere between 180,000 and 1.5 million vaccine victims. And since 1986, in U.S. dollars, this represents over $1 billion paid out by the U.S. government to families and loved ones of those who experienced adverse reactions caused by the vaccine. However, to protect themselves and their bottom line, drug manufacturers lobby Congress to place a limit on awards paid to families whose child died as a result of vaccination. No family can receive more than $250,000 plus attorney's fees and costs for the death of a child. Sadly, the cloud of the powerful vaccine industry must be borne by those who can least tolerate the pressure. What is the price of a child's life? Most of the general public is unaware of the adverse effects attributed to vaccines. Most doctors rarely discuss vaccine dangers with their patients prior to immunization. In most cases, it is only afterwards, when a child is laying in a hospital seizing or immunologically distressed, that vaccine dangers are discussed. It is at this time that most parents discover vaccines have been linked to asthma, autism, attention deficit disorder, and numerous other immunological disorders. It is usually at this moment that parents learn that some children's immune systems cannot tolerate the toxic ingredients used to produce vaccines. Yet, it is common knowledge in many medical and scientific communities that all vaccines have the potential to cause an adverse reaction in some children. Why? One reason for adverse reactions to vaccines can be found in the lack of infant immune system testing. Prior to infants and toddlers receiving their vaccines, they should be tested to determine if their system has been compromised by infection or genetic weakness. At a recent international public conference on vaccination held in Arlington, Virginia, in September of 2000, scientists, academics, and doctors cited concerns regarding the common practice by pediatricians to routinely give infants and toddlers inoculations even if they had colds, the flu, or other sickness, increasing the chances of adverse reactions. Even the manufacturer's vaccine package insert, which most parents should read but never get the opportunity, states that vaccines should not be administered to immune-compromised or immune-suppressed individuals, i.e. children who are sick or recovering from cold or flu symptoms, among other maladies. If pediatricians would take the time to run a few tests or ask a few more questions regarding the health of an infant prior to vaccine, we would identify more children who should not be given the shots. Another contributing factor to increasing reactions is the ingredients found in vaccines and their production processes. Most people would be quite surprised to learn how vaccines are actually made and to see the list of ingredients. To produce vaccines, one must first acquire the disease germ using either a toxic bacterium or a live virus. The theory behind vaccines is that in order to build immunity against the disease within the human body, a viral or bacterial infected antigen must be introduced directly into the bloodstream. This is done to fool the body's immune system into producing antibodies that will resist the actual disease should the body ever be confronted by such. Once these antibodies are formed, temporary immunity from the disease is achieved, or so the theory goes. To make a live vaccine, the live virus must be attenuated or weakened for human consumption. This is accomplished through a serial passage, which is where the greatest risk presents itself. The disease germ or virus is passed through animal tissue several times to reduce its potency for humans. For example, the measles virus passed through chick embryos. The polio virus is passed through monkey kidneys. The rubella virus is passed through human diploid cells, the dissected organs of aborted fetuses. Sound incredible? Then the weakened germ is strengthened with adjuvants, meaning antibody boosters, by adding drugs and toxic disinfectants like aluminum hydrochloride, sorbitol, formaldehyde, which is embalming fluid, sodium chloride, and thimerosal, which is a mercury derivative, used as a preservative. Taken alone, aluminum, formaldehyde, and mercury have long histories of documented hazardous effects on the human system, including but not limited to cancer, neurological damage, and death. If a parent follows a recommended immunization schedule, all of these toxins would be injected approximately 16 times into the body of a child less than 2 years old. A recent June 2000 joint policy statement released by the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices in U.S. Public Health Service announced that these organizations were jointly recommending, quote, the removal of the vaccine preservative, mercury, as soon as possible from vaccines routinely recommended for infants, unquote. This announcement was made in response to, quote, public concern about the health effects of mercury exposure of any sort, unquote. Now imagine, what does that tell you about the hundreds of millions of vaccines they have given with the mercury in there? And what effects that's had? And it's still not out of the vaccines. A prevailing danger of vaccine production occurs during serial passage, where foreign genetic material from the animal or the cells of what you're putting it through, the egg or the kidney cells of the monkey, or the aborted fetuses, may unknowingly be transferred from one host to another. Undetected, animal virus can be passed along during the attenuation process where the live virus is passed through animal tissue. Many animal viruses remain relatively unknown and can easily be passed on to humans through the vaccine. In fact, so many previously unknown viruses have been detected that they have begun numbering them. This is exactly what happened in the late 50s when thousands of Africans were injected with a polio vaccine contaminated with an unknown monkey virus, now called simian virus 40, the 40th virus of this type to be detected since researchers began looking. This simian virus 40 is a powerful immune system suppressant and believed to be a trigger for HIV. Author Edward Hooper, in the 1999 release of his book, In the River, A Journey to the Source of HIV and AIDS, detailed how the polio vaccine was made using live virus extracted from the monkey kidneys and how this ancestor of HIV could have been introduced to humans via vaccines to produce the outbreak. A live virus extracted from an animal or human indisputably poses a high level of risk when introduced into a human immune system. Even though the virus is weakened, the diseased germ is still being injected directly into the bloodstream. The complete composition and function of most virus still remains an anomaly to modern scientists. Drug manufacturers refuse to fund research to determine the long-term effects of introducing live virus into the human immune system. Yet in the new millennium, we continue to use vaccines containing live virus. The measles, mumps, rubella, the Varivax, which is chickenpox, and the polio vaccine. These are live polio virus. But, by the way, in October 1999, a vaccine using a live virus developed to prevent rotavirus infection, which causes childhood diarrhea, was pulled off the market. Nearly 1 year after its introduction, over 1 million injections to infants via vaccination, it was found to increase the risk of bowel obstruction. And while some problems were most likely revealed during testing, this vaccine was determined to be safe enough to introduce to the American public due to the small number of reported problems. Almost 100 cases of bowel obstruction reported to the government in less than a year. Yet, public health officials have decided that the good of the many outweighs the risks of the few. Today, a growing number of scientists and medical professionals are recognizing a direct correlation between the increase in autoimmune disorders and the increasing number of vaccine injections. Asthma, autism, attention deficit disorder, diabetes are all classified as autoimmune disorders. Between 1982 and 1992, the United States introduced 6 new vaccines to the mandatory vaccine schedule, 5 doses of live poliovirus, 2 doses of live viral measles, mumps and rubella, 4 doses of Hib, and 3 doses of hepatitis B. During the same period, the Centers for Disease Control reports a 50% increase in asthma sufferers for persons between the ages of 5 and 34. Deaths from asthma increased 52% during the same period. And amongst what group in asthma was most prevalent? African Americans are 300% more likely to die from asthma than whites, according to a study by S.G. Stolberg reported in the New York Times. Are vaccines killing our children? Stolberg's study states the hospitalization rate for asthma is 21 times higher in the Bronx and Harlem than in more affluent areas of the city. Could this dramatic increase in asthma amongst poor children be attributed to immune suppressive causes by a barrage of vaccines, inadequate medical care and insurance, and environmental factors? To date, health officials have not conducted any long-term research to uncover the answers to these questions. Diabetes, another chronic autoimmune disorder, has increased 300% to nearly 16 million since 1985. It is now the 4th leading cause of death in the United States. In 1999, 1 in 1,000 children was diagnosed with autism, a 40% increase. Today, autism is more prevalent among children than cancer, multiple sclerosis, and cystic fibrosis. A California study put the increase in autism closer to 273% in a 10-year period from 1987 to 98. Attention deficit disorder has increased somewhere between 50% over the past decade, and it has become so prevalent in some urban school districts that those diagnosed with this immunological disorders outnumber the normal students in many classrooms. Are all these increases in autoimmune disorders just coincidence? Certainly there are other factors that could be attributed to these increases: diet, socioeconomic factors, etc., or misdiagnosis. However, the one common link that prevails in each case is vaccination. Are vaccines safe for everyone, or are they merely shots of faith? Faith that the U.S. government and the drug companies will not mislead us, not fail to disclose certain information regarding vaccine safety. We have just seen willful failure to disclose dangerous side effects with the tobacco industry, the auto industry, with Firestone tires. Are drug companies, vaccine manufacturers capable of the same willful deception? If you were to poll the estimated 1 million people who reported adverse vaccine reactions, they would probably say, no, vaccines are not safe. If we are to poll the 5,000 families who file claims with the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, they would most likely concur that vaccines are not safe for everyone. But if we polled medical professionals, many would respond that vaccines have worked wonderful in ways to control the spread of disease worldwide. They've saved thousands of lives, they would say, and helped eradicate several life-threatening diseases. Is this true? I'll tell you that in the next part of our program. The theory behind the vaccine program is laudable. Worldwide, immunization programs, we are told, have halted the rampant spread of polio, smallpox, and a sundry of other diseases. But are vaccines safe for all? According to recent research, the answer is indisputably no. Most of the medical profession has conceded that vaccines are not for everyone. Some children, and often entire families, are predisposed to adverse vaccine reactions. The cause of this phenomenon is unknown because no public or private sector tests have been conclusive and complete enough to make a determination. This position is partly attributed to fear on the part of the drug companies that acknowledgement and determination of the cause might invite increased liability in lawsuits. In 1999, France halted the required hepatitis B vaccines for school children as a result of a lawsuit filed by its citizenry. The people of France decided to sue their government, alleging that government health officials understated the risk of hepatitis B vaccine, citing the risk in autoimmune disorders following the vaccine, and exaggerated its benefits. In the United States, the jury is still out on hepatitis B vaccine. However, recently the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons called for an immediate moratorium on mandatory hepatitis B vaccine for school children, pending further research into the dangerous side effects. And the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons is not alone in their position. Several medical organizations have found the courage to speak out in opposition to certain vaccines or to the idea of mandatory vaccines. Many medical professionals argue that mandatory vaccine programs are a violation of patient rights to make their own health decisions. In all 50 states, certain vaccines are required for children to enter public or private schools, yet it is known as a fact that some children are predisposed to adverse vaccine reactions. Where is our freedom of choice? This question has been presented before many legislative bodies, including congressional hearings. The government response is that vaccines promote the common good, which is a society free of disease and its effects. In essence, the U.S. government appears willing to risk a few for the many. That concept might sound honorable and noble until you take a careful examination. Are we free of disease? Are we healthy because of vaccinations? I challenge that we are among the most sick nation of the world, for many different reasons, and that we cannot suggest with any scientific credibility at all that the vaccination of a child is guaranteed for that individual child to be both protective and safe. There is no scientific research anywhere that I'm aware of to make that decision. I believe it's important at this time that we begin to galvanize our resources as individual citizens and citizen rights groups to bring actions, much as they did in France, in effect to sue the government and to sue the manufacturers and force a public dialogue where it's not just the hand-picked special representatives of vaccine companies that appear before government committees saying vaccines are safe and effective, and that we stop rewriting history and are honest about what really has caused the reduction in these disease rates over the years. Until we do that, we are not exercising our constitutional rights of freedom of choice. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a short station ID break, and when I come back, I will methodically dissect the argument that it is because of vaccines that we no longer have polio and smallpox and other major infectors. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
And good afternoon. At 12:45, as I said, we got a bit of a late start this afternoon, but we will have two, that's right, count them, two produced portions of Natural Living with Gary Null. We just concluded the first portion and another uninterrupted 30-minute section of Natural Living with Gary Null is coming up. We would like to thank the people at the Westerly Organic Market for providing fresh organic fruit to the volunteers this morning, and Urban Organics as well. We are still awaiting the lunch from the restaurant, the RBG restaurant at 37th 3rd Avenue, and we thank them very, very much. I mean, you know, it's some very interesting and troubling information, Matthew, and good afternoon. Autism more prevalent today than cancer in children and several other autoimmune conditions. Mercury in the vaccines that we are being vaccinated with. I mean, it's some heavy stuff. I think what you have to ask yourself is whether or not you are better served having this information than not having this information. And I think the answer is just quite simply yes.
Yes.
And what we're asking you to do, as you know, saying that, well, I really appreciate having this information or having access to this information, that this information comes to me each and every day, Monday through Friday, from 12 until 1 p.m. without interruption, is to support this radio station in the middle of the FM band. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. And our number during our fundraising drive, our pledge drive, is 212-209-2950, and we have some incentives to get you to pledge to this radio station, and they're incentives for you. They're not just things that you don't need, the things that you do need that may be very, very useful and helpful to you.
That's right, things that you can put directly to use, just as the information that you've been hearing all day on this radio station is meant to not just sort of lay there, but to be put to use. What Gary has put together and is offering in exchange for your vote of support in listener-sponsored radio here in the middle of the FM dial, in the fat part of the commercial band of the FM dial, your support keeps us here and keeps us breathing and keeps us broadcasting. And we are now at the halfway point of this fundraising drive, beginning to sniff ever so vaguely the finish line. But we do need your support, continued support. Gary came on about a week and a day ago, initially talking about his brand new book just released by Seven Stories Press in hardcover called The Food, Mood, Body Connection. A massive book talking directly about the misdiagnosis, for instance, of mental illness and learning disabilities, including autism, among young people, that is often not those things at all, but in fact comes from food allergies or imbalances and overabundance of sugar in the bloodstream and the like. That runs not only through childhood, but has effects upon the adult life and as we age, what food does to our perspectives, our moods, our energy levels most especially, and our stress levels. So that book, The Food, Mood, Body Connection, brand new from Gary Null, is available with our thanks for those of you who can make a pledge to support listener sponsorship here of $125. There is also a De-Stressing Your Life video, 30 Ways to De-Stress Your Life. This is an elegantly filmed, primarily lecture from Gary Null. And that volume, a two-hour presentation from Gary, is available to our audience, our listeners, and available for you to share as well. That for a pledge of $100. And just in the last few days, the Kensington Group, I believe, has issued into paperback one of the most popular works that Gary has done to date, and that is the massive 612-page book, The Complete Encyclopedia of Natural Healing, a comprehensive A to Z listing of common and chronic illnesses and their proven natural treatments. Yes, indeed. That huge book is also available to you in paperback this time for a pledge of $100. We had a good showing yesterday. We want to try to stay on course. We want to try to wrap up here by as
Matthew,
close to two as we can.
Let me give people a little different perspective on why the Complete Encyclopedia of Natural Healing and the brand new book that we haven't discussed in a couple of days, The Food Move Body Connection, what makes them really different?
Okay, and as Gary goes into that explanation, remember we can be taking your pledges at 212-209-2950.
And you can use your Visa or your MasterCard or American Express if you so choose. Just call the folks in Tally. They are awaiting your calls now at 212-209-2950.
There are more than 2,000 books currently available on health issues. It's a very important, hot topic. Wasn't always that way. And I get virtually every book that's published on health. One, because people want their authors on the program, and two, because I go into Barnes & Noble virtually every day, 7 days a week, and to see what new titles in all different areas come in, because I'm a voracious reader and I love to read on all different types of topics. My most favorite are comparative religion, which I never discuss, and geopolitical, political issues throughout the world, and a lot of topics that I have of my own hobby and interest. So I know what's being published, and there's a big degree in quality in what goes into a book. It was 22 years ago, in fact, it was just 1 year after I was on BAI, that I asked a group of people who shall remain nameless, but they were amongst the most popular holistic physicians in the country, to a meeting. And we had 27 people all told at that meeting, I believe. And the idea was, if they could simply take their clinical experience, what they were doing with their patients, because they pretty much all had specialties, and if they could give me the data, I would then input it into a system of reports so that when they were challenged, or other doctors using similar therapies were challenged for chelation, for example, or for helping people with an environmental illness, which was really being attacked as a condition that did not exist. And there was a Dr. Ray down in Texas who was doing great work in helping people, but he was being attacked. And Dr. Ray Wunderlich, who was helping children in Florida, was being attacked. And Dr. Cupsonell was being attacked. And Dr. Lance in Utah using chelation was being attacked. So all over the country, these people had been attacked. And they were attacked because they were told by their state medical boards, the media, where's the proof that what you're doing works? And they could say, well, I had a patient, and, well, that's anecdotal. And I said, it's just as easy. It takes no more money or time or effort for you to fill out this card. And I gave them a card that had the type of disease, the previous diagnosis, the previous treatment, where they had been. It takes maybe 10, 15 minutes for a patient to fill it out, and the doctor reviews it. And then as the patient is treated at the end of that time, all the data before and after could be put on there, and then that becomes a part of a ongoing in-office controlled study. And if you have 1,000 or 2,000 patients over a year or two or three, then you have a good database. And then when someone challenges you, you have proof positive based upon the studies you've done in your own office. And everyone thought it was a good idea, and that it was needed. It was needed for the greater good of the holistic health community. It was needed because it allowed people, patients, to have the confidence that their treatment and their getting better would help other people see that this just wasn't quackery. Well, 3 weeks later, I sent out these cards to everyone. And then I followed up with phone calls, and I followed up with a letter. A year later, not one single person had sent in one single card. Even when I started bringing people in the greater New York area and asked one doctor to keep meticulous records by category, your hepatitis patients, your cancer patients, he didn't do it. I asked another one, he didn't do it. Now, they had the patients, and they were using my protocols, and the patients were getting better. And so finally, After reading their books, and I saw that their books did not have the proof necessary. Anybody can make any statement. You're covered under freedom of speech. You can say anything you want. And they did. And then what would happen is, and being a best-selling author and having a longevity in the field, there's a certain number of actors that they can open a film. Tom Hanks and Tom Cruise and Mel Gibson. Well, in publishing, it's no different. You know, there are certain authors, like a Stephen King, you know, he's going to, no matter what he does, you know, if he wrote his name on the back of a postage stamp, someone's going to buy it. But I was seeing that some people who were well known were writing books, but when I read their books, there was no substance. There was nothing provable. And yet these people had the resources to do their homework, and they didn't. And I spoke with these people, and one of the most famous, and certainly one of the most wealthy, I had dinner with one night at an Indian restaurant here in New York City, and I said, look, if you don't want to take the time or effort to do it, I'll do it. I'll hire someone to go in your office. I'll pay them. You don't have to do that. And all they'll do is take your data and go, okay, good idea. And I hired someone, and 2 weeks later, nobody wanted to cooperate with him. So, ended again. So I then decided, okay, the only books that I will write will be books based upon good quality research data. Data that if I'm questioned or challenged on any single thing I said, I can have a ton of information to back it up. That meant that I had to do more research than anyone else writing in the history of the alternative field. But I did, and because I was a scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, because I've done more clinical studies, listen carefully what I'm going to tell you, I've done more clinical studies than all the other doctors in the holistic field combined. Take every single holistic doctor alive today, all of them, and I've done more studies. And that's not a good statement. That's a bad statement. That's a bad statement because I'm not an MD. I shouldn't be doing their work. I shouldn't be spending the money I have to spend and taking the years of effort and organizing and all. You have no idea what's involved. You have to do meticulous work on this. But they're not willing to do it. They're willing to write a book that says, oh, they can cure cancer, they can cure this, or they can cure that. There are even some books that have got a whole bunch of people saying they can do all this stuff. And unfortunately, you, the public, don't understand. These are their opinions. Now, their opinions could be right, their opinions could be wrong. Where's the data? Where's the hard data? Doesn't exist. Therefore, they've left themselves open to be attacked. And as a result of them being attacked, the entire field has been attacked. And even when the Office of Alternative Therapies opened, I met with Dr. Jacobs, the director of it, at the National Institutes of Health. And he said to me, my hands are tied. I cannot have enough money to do a study that's meaningful. It's all window dressing. I remember him saying that, sitting right in my living room, saying, Gary, it's all just a window dressing. They've done it just so that they can say they funded alternative therapy and therefore they're not biased. They were biased and remain biased. So the only way that we, those of us interested, like yourself and others, in seeing non-toxic and non-invasive therapies made available is we have to do more work than anyone else. And we have to do it in such a way that it can be replicated and published. And I've done over 41 studies. And some of these studies have taken 2 years and involved 1,000 or 2,000 people with blood chemistries and hormone levels and medical exams, and all that has to be put into a computer and evaluated, and you have to have independent medical biostatisticians to evaluate it, until finally one day, in a 30-second statement, you can say, ah, garlic can bring down cholesterol, and did so in these people. But you have no idea what went into that. So when I wrote the Food Move Body Connection, there's proof about everything in there. So if you're a person who's concerned about hypothyroidism or hypoglycemia being misdiagnosed as depression and given tranquilizers, and that you can clean the body up and rebalance your thyroid and rebalance your blood chemistry and therefore have normal and healthy functioning emotions, there's a lot of proof behind it. If you notice in the back of my book, I give a tremendous amount of time and space to footnotes and scientific statements. Now, my publisher doesn't want me to do that. They say it's wasted. We could do a book that's 150 pages shorter. And I said, yes, you could. But I want people to know that there's proof for every statement. When you go to the new paperback, 600-page Complete Encyclopedia of Natural Healing, and if you look in there under the prostate and you look at the protocols that are given, that wasn't just thrown together. That's because those are the protocols that have been used on hundreds of men where we have the results and we have the before and afters of the PSAs. So there's good evidence. And no matter what your condition, Parkinson's disease, when you sit in a health support group and you hear people standing up saying, I had periodontal disease, I had gingivitis, and I had infections for about 3 years, and nothing was working, and I was given antibiotics, but now, a year later, I don't have gingivitis, and it's cleared up. That's a study. That's one person with good documentation, before and after, medical records, before and after, and yet I put it in there just as information. What did that person do? And if you were to call and ask me, Gary, how many people do you have who had breast cancer, went on holistic protocols, and today their cancer has improved or gone away? A lot. And since they all use the same protocol, then that legitimizes that there's a...